Hello and welcome to CMV in Stem Cell and Kidney Transplant, Overcoming the Limitations of Conventional Antiviral Therapy. This activity is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck. I'm Dr. Genoveva Papanikolaou. I'm an attending physician in the Infectious Disease Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and professor at Weill Cornell Medical College of Cornell University, both in New York City. I'm very pleased to be joined today by my esteemed colleague, Dr. Camille Cotton, whom I will ask to introduce herself.
Thank you, Xenia. I'm Camille Nelson Cotton. I'm the Clinical Director of Transplant and Immunocompromised Host Infectious Diseases Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School.
Thank you, Camille. I'm looking forward to our discussions. Here are our learning objectives for today's program. After participating in this activity, learners should be better able to identify the burden and impact of CMV infection in patients receiving renal transplant or stem cell transplant. We will review the benefits and limitations of standard antiviral therapies for prevention and treatment of CMV, and how to incorporate novel antivirals for CMV prophylaxis and treatment into our clinical practice. Camille, perhaps you can start by addressing our first learning objective and how it applies to renal transplantation, and then I will provide some additional stem cell transplant perspective.
Yes, of course. So we know that CMV is the most common infection after solid organ transplantation. We see that the heaviest burden is in those who are what we call a CMV mismatch or CMV donor seropositive, recipient seronegative, which is roughly a quarter of the U.S. solid organ transplant population. The majority of kidney transplant recipients in the United States are CMV seropositive, so at lower risk for disease. And that rate depends on your local demographics. In many parts of the world, they do have higher CMV seropositive populations, for example, in India or Brazil, where they do a lot of organ transplants. But so the rate of and risk of CMV there is significantly lower. And development of a highly effective vaccine or other robust immunologic protection through antibodies, et cetera, has actually been quite elusive. And they've looked for CMV vaccines in this field for well over 60 years. Prevention is key for all solid organ transplant recipients. And so people should either get prophylaxis or preemptive therapy. And there's some interesting information out there about maybe people on mTORs don't need prevention for CMV seropositives. So lots going on in the field. I found some really interesting information. This is from the SRTR data set. The Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients data set. Looking from 2015 through 2019 at all kidney transplant recipients. And you can see that in many parts of the country, the rates of CMV seropositivity and the rates of mismatch can vary. So I thought that this would be an interesting map that was put together by Margaret Jorgensen and colleagues. In order to think about your own local risk. And now I will turn this over to you, Xenia.
Sure. Like the solid organ transplant world, the CMV is also one of the most serious and common viral infections after stem cell transplant. The difference is that most infections in the stem cell transplant recipients arise from reactivation of latent CMV in the recipient. So the greatest risk factor is CMV recipient seropositivity. And talking about the frequency of these reactivations, about 60 to 70% of seropositive recipients will reactivate after stem cell transplantation, while if you are a CMV negative recipient but received a graft from a CMV seropositive donor, the frequency of primary CMV infection is about 20%. And these days, really, the risk of CMV transmission from blood transfusions is practically zero. Usually, asymptomatic viremia precedes end organ disease. However, if left untreated, viremia can result in end organ disease. And again, like solid organ transplants, prevention or early treatment are key. We know that CMV infection, CMV has very broad tropism and can affect really any organ. The most common manifestation of CMV disease these days is enterocolitis. However, other organs can be affected, including the lungs, and CMV pneumonitis is associated with very high mortality, and other privileged sites such as retinitis or encephalitis cases have occurred. One of the very important and interesting aspects of CMV in the stem cell transplantation is survival disparity between CMV seropositive and seronegative recipients, even in the setting of preemptive therapy. And we can see perhaps later how this may have changed or may change with a use of prophylaxis. The main risk factors for CMV disease after transplant are, I will only focus in transplant-related factors, which basically is anything that delays immune reconstitution, so any form of T-cell depletion, including post-transplant cyclophosphamide or graft versus host disease and the associated treatments. And the degree of mismatch, particularly cord blood transplants, because the cord grafts are naive to CMV and they have a great degree of mismatch, they are at very high risk for CMV. And again, as mentioned earlier, the CMV seropositivity of the recipient is the greatest risk factor. Now, let's move on to our second learning objective and review the benefits and limitations of standard antiviral therapies for the prevention and treatment of CMV. Camille, would you like to start us up with the solid organ transplants?
Sure. So for CMV prevention, there are two main approaches. One is prophylaxis, and that's when we give antiviral prophylaxis, usually either valganciclovir or letemovir, for sort of 3 to 6 months after transplant. It can be dependent on the organ and other programmatic issues, but in general, many patients get 3 to 6 months of prophylaxis versus preemptive monitoring. And so preemptive monitoring is when weekly blood work is done for 12 to 16 weeks after transplant. And when CMV is detected and at a certain locally defined threshold, either by viral load or DNAemia, or if they're doing antigenemia, you know, when they've achieved a certain threshold, then CMV treatment is initiated. Both of these approaches are generally considered quite acceptable, especially for kidney and liver transplant. A little less where we have less data for things like lung transplant, intestinal transplant, and some of the more high-risk CMV, where we generally do prefer prophylaxis. There's something really interesting that came out of the second version of the International Consensus Guidelines on CMV Management After Solid Organ Transplant, and that is this concept of a hybrid approach where we use both prophylaxis and surveillance. So basically, patients get 3 to 6 months of antiviral prophylaxis, and then they get weekly monitoring, usually for about 12 weeks afterwards. And again, that's their highest risk period coming off prophylaxis for them to develop CMV. And if they hit a certain threshold, that's where we would initiate treatment dose. In general, we don't do this for everybody. It's a lot. It's quite labor intensive, and it's a lot for the patient to have to go to the lab every week. But we do recommend it for high risk populations, for example, that up to a quarter of transplants that are donor positive, recipient negative for CMV, or where there's more potent immunosuppression or other issues that seem like this these patients would be at high risk for developing what we call late CMV. So just to address the different mechanisms of action for our standard antiviral therapies, you can see in this nice slide of a CMV-infected human cell, the various areas where different agents target. So ganciclovir and cidofovir are analogs of deoxyguanosine and deoxycytidine. And you can see that they affect the cellular kinases, ganciclovir working through this PUL97 kinase affecting the cellular kinases, and then later also having another mechanism of action. Valganciclovir is purely just an oral prodrug of ganciclovir. Ganciclovir does require that phosphorylation in order to become active, and that's why that UL97 gene is the area where we see the most mutations that result in ganciclovir resistance. And then both ganciclovir and cidofovir require phosphorylation by host cellular phosphokinases, and both competitively inhibit the viral DNA polymerase UL54 at the site of the deoxynucleoside triphosphate binding. Now, foscarnet is an analog of pyrophosphate and inhibits UL54 at the pyrophosphate binding site. And so different mechanism of action. And although there can be shared resistances among ganciclovir and cidofovir, there are far fewer between foscarnet and ganciclovir. All right, so that's how the standard agents work. Zenya, do you want to talk about some of the specific clinical issues?
Sure. We know these drugs, for the most part, work. Ganciclovir and foscarnet are the ones most commonly used, but they are associated with substantial side effects. And here we have an overview of the key adverse events. And so ganciclovir, the hallmark toxicity is myelosuppression and specifically neutropenia. They have a boxed warning for neutropenia, and which is typically dose dependent, meaning it occurs the longer you use ganciclovir. And valganciclovir, as you mentioned, is an oral prodrug of ganciclovir. It's orally administered, but also has the same hematologic toxicity as ganciclovir. Now, foscarnet comes only in an intravenous formulation, a great antiviral, but very labor-intensive from the part of the healthcare system. It requires a very long infusion time, and it requires intense electrolyte monitoring and replacement, as it can cause hypokalemia, hypocalcemia, etc. I would say that fluid overload is common in patients that required foscarnet for a long time. And also, genital ulcers happen due to crystallization of foscarnet in the area, in the genital area. Now, cidofovir is something that fortunately we don't have to use frequently. I would say that I don't remember where I used it last for CMV. But also is nephrotoxic and is actually contraindicated in patients with proteinuria. So overall, while for the most part ganciclovir and foscarnet work, they are associated with toxicities and a burden to the healthcare system with either frequent monitoring, sometimes requiring growth factors to counteract the myelosuppression and also nephrotoxicity for foscarnet. And now let's move to our last learning objectives. Let's dive right into the new antivirals. Now, in terms of how new antivirals work, we've added letermovir and maribavir to the earlier graph. And starting with letermovir, it works in the terminase complex. This is a combination of enzymes that work out to cut the long DNA that is produced into the right size virion so it can be packaged, and thus inhibition of this terminase complex prevents the functional virions. Maribavir inhibits the PUL97 kinase, which is very much involved in viral replication and synthesis and the exit of the virions from the nucleus. Camille, can you tell us about letermovir in clinical practice?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So letermovir was recently approved for use in high-risk kidney transplant patients. It was initially approved for seropositive stem cell transplant recipients back in 2017, and then just over a year ago in high-risk D+ R- kidney transplant recipients. Important to know is that there are some drug interactions. So unlike valganciclovir, where we didn't have to worry about drug interactions, it can have interactions with tacrolimus, cyclosporin, and azoles. It's also significantly more expensive than valganciclovir by multiple factors. It is recommended in a recent paper by Winstead et al. That when you start letermovir, that the tacrolimus dose be reduced by 40 to 50%. So that's quite significant and worth contemplating how to integrate that into your programmatic issues. There's pretty easy to dose 480 milligrams once a day. If they're on cyclosporin, it's half that dose. So overall, pretty straightforward, and we're happy to have it available to us. I would like to take a few minutes to review the key trial results that were published last June. So this was published by Dr. Ajit LeMay in JAMA, and this was a study looking at CMV donor-positive recipient-negative kidney transplant recipients, where they compared letermovir, 480 milligrams a day, given with acyclovir, because it's important to realize letermovir only covers CMV. So letermovir with acyclovir, so the acyclovir is to prevent disseminated zoster and HSV, or valganciclovir, 900 milligrams daily, adjusted for kidney function for up to 200 days after transplant. And so the outcomes as far as confirmed CMV disease were really about the same at sort of 10 to 11%. And that was after adjudication by the adjudication committee. Otherwise, each center said that there was a CMV disease rate after prophylaxis of about 17% in each arm. So really looking very equivalent as far as prevention of CMV disease. Leukopenia was seen at 11% in those that got letermovir versus 37% for those that got valganciclovir. And similarly, neutropenia was lower at 3% versus 17% in letermovir versus valganciclovir by week 28. And so that less of a bone marrow toxicity with letermovir compared to valganciclovir. Quantifiable CMV DNAemia was seen in just over 2% of those on letermovir prophylaxis versus 8.8% for those on valganciclovir seen by week 28. And regarding participants who were evaluated for suspected CMV disease or CMV DNAemia, none of those on letermovir versus about 12% who received valganciclovir had resistance-associated substitutions. And fewer in the letermovir group had to stop prophylaxis due to adverse events or drug-related adverse events compared to valganciclovir. What I highlighted in blue was that valganciclovir dosing was adjusted to renal function, but we don't actually have those details. But if they, you know, it's very hard to accurately calculate kidney function in a kidney transplant recipient. All kinds of factors play into that. So it's possible that these patients were either overdosed or underdosed, which many of us that are familiar with dosing valganciclovir realize how important that is and how challenging it is. But that could explain the neutropenia and breakthrough infection rates. And then the IMPACT trial that looked at 100 days versus 200 days of valganciclovir prophylaxis did report neutropenia at a rate of 3% after 100 days and 5% after 200 days. So overall, much lower in that IMPACT trial. So I would love to see data on what the valganciclovir dosing was like to see if we could explain some of the trial data here. But nonetheless, really good outcomes for both for letermovir as far as prophylaxis and overall tolerability. So good news. We're happy to have a new tool in the toolbox. Now, let's talk about letermovir for use in non-kidney organ transplant recipients. So these were not included in the large trial that I just presented. That was just kidneys. So these are primarily single-center studies. And overall, there seemed to be similar success as with kidneys, albeit with very small data sets. And it does prevent CMV, but not other human herpes virus. So it's, as I mentioned, important to include an additional agent to prevent disseminated zoster, especially if you're not vaccinating people fully prior to transplant, something like acyclovir, valacyclovir, famvir. And given significant drug interactions with tacrolimus, really important to reduce the dose by 40 to 50% when you start the letermovir. All right, so now I'm going to pass the baton back to you. Let's talk about stem cell transplant recipients and letermovir.
Sure. So I'm going to spend just a few minutes on the registration trial of letermovir because it was really a pivotal trial. It was the first trial done specifically for prophylaxis in CMV seropositive recipients. That showed a difference in CMV infection at the end of week 24. And also, I'm going to highlight that it showed an impact in all-cause mortality at week 24. So, just to summarize, this was a large randomized placebo-controlled multicenter study in CMV seropositive recipients. It was a global study. The patients were randomized to receive letermovir or placebo through week 14, and the primary endpoint was assessed at week 24. So the primary endpoint of CMV, clinically significant CMV infection, was assessed 10 weeks after stopping the prophylaxis. It's important to know that only patients that started with non-detected CMV PCR were included in this primary endpoint evaluation. And you see that at the end of week 24, approximately 37% of patients in the letermovir arm, compared to 60% in the placebo arm, had met the primary endpoint, which is actually not only clinically significant CMV infection, but any other discontinuation for any other reasons or missing data. So we will see later that the actual clinically significant CMV infection was much less than these numbers. Now, one of the secondary endpoints was if letermovir worked during the period that it was given. So, looking at the clinically significant CMV infection by week 14. And again, we see that 20% of patients in the letermovir arm compared to 50% met this endpoint. And the third and most important for me is the difference in all-cause mortality. It's a 5% difference at week 24, which was statistically significant. Now, looking at what happened after stopping letermovir, so after completion of 100 days of letermovir, there were rebound infections. So while about 7% of patients developed breakthrough infection by week 14, by week 24, so after stopping letermovir, there were 19% of patients that developed clinically significant infection. When this group of patients that developed this rebound infection was looked closely, They found that concomitant steroid use or baseline high risk, meaning that any form of T-cell depletion or mismatched graft were associated with developing this rebound infection after stopping letermovir. And that led into the extended duration study that was recently published in Lancet Hematology. This was a study that took patients that had successfully reached day 100 without any CMV reactivation. They had all received letermovir. And at day 100, they were randomized to either receiving another 100 days of letermovir prophylaxis, so for a total of 200 days, or placebo, meaning the prophylaxis would end at 100 days. And the primary endpoint of this trial was clinically significant CMV infection at the 200 days at the end of therapy. And the trial met the endpoint. The failures by week 28, which is the 200-day mark, were 3% in the letermovir 200 days compared to 19% when letermovir was given 100 days. Now, looking into further time points, meaning from week 14 to week 38 or to week 48, we see that the patients with the extended duration prophylaxis developed some rebound CMV after stopping letermovir at 200 days. And by the end of the study at week 48, there was very little difference, 13% versus 19% of patients in the 200-day versus 100-day had developed clinically significant infection. So again, even for the 200 days, letermovir worked while it was given, but after stopping it, there were some rebound infections. Now, importantly, we know that all clinically significant CMV infections are not equal. And from what we know, at least in clinical practice, infections that occur later after transplant when the immune system is stronger, patients are able to handle it with shorter durations of antivirals and without bad consequences such as CMV disease. And again, CMV disease in this trial in both arms was exceedingly low, if I remember correctly, one or two cases. Now, let's move a little bit to the real world. Certain centers, including my center at Sloan Kettering, we had adopted letermovir for 180 days, even before the results of the extended duration study. And these are some of the results in our population where high-risk patients received minimum 180 days of letermovir. Low-risk patients received 100 days, but if they developed GVHD and they were on steroids, letermovir was prolonged. And here is the impact on mortality at 1 year. We used as comparator the CMV negative patients. And you can see that prior to letermovir, so in historical controls, prior to letermovir, no letermovir, the CMV seropositive recipients had higher all-cause mortality. And with the implementation of letermovir, we see that the seropositive recipients have equal, similar over all-cause mortality as to the negative patients. And when we looked at the biggest benefit, the type of patients that had the biggest benefit in terms of mortality were really the T-cell depleted patients that are at the highest risk of CMV. We see an 80% reduction in mortality in T-cell depleted patients. Now, moving away from letermovir and prophylaxis, we are going to take a look at maribavir, which is the newest anti-CMV drug approved for resistant or refractory CMV. And this was based on the result of the phase 3 trial, the Solstice trial, that included stem cell and solid organ transplant patients with treatment refractory CMV. And refractory CMV was defined as no virologic response after at least 2 weeks of appropriately dosed antiviral therapy. Patients could have resistance mutations or without resistance mutations. Patients were randomized in an open-label fashion to receive maribavir or the investigator-assigned therapy for 8 weeks. The primary endpoint was confirmed viremia clearance at the end of week 8. And we can see that maribavir was superior to the investigator's choice for viremia clearance at week 8. And when looking at subsequent endpoints at week 12, 18, and 20, we still see superiority of maribavir in terms of maintaining viremia clearance plus symptom control. And when we looked at subgroups, including solid organ versus stem cell transplant, what was the investigator's choice therapy, viral load, we can see that in all these subgroups, maribavir performed similarly and was superior to the investigator-assigned therapy. Now let's talk about safety. One of the problems that we mentioned with the conventional antivirals have been adverse events. The signature toxicity of maribavir is dysgeusia, so alteration of taste or bad taste. And we can see again that compared to the investigator's choice, maribavir patients randomized to maribavir had experienced more dysgeusia. And more GI events like nausea, diarrhea. Although here, diarrhea and vomiting were pretty similar between the two arms. And if I remember correctly, there were no patients that discontinued the drug before because of dysgeusia, or it was a very small percentage. Now, as is known, the major toxicity that was seen with ganciclovir was neutropenia, and you can see 33.9% compared to 9% with maribavir. And the major toxicity of foscarnet was acute renal injury, and you can see 21% in the foscarnet arm compared to 8.5% in the maribavir arm. So in summary, with maribavir, we do have a safer antiviral that can work for patients with resistant or refractory CMV. And now to help put together the information we presented into clinical perspective, we are going to look at two cases, one in solid organ and one in stem cell transplant, to see how we can implement these new antivirals in clinical practice. Camille, please tell us about your case.
Thanks, Zenya. I think that I'll put what you just taught us into active clinical practice. So this is a case of a 72-year-old man with a history of type 2 diabetes, hypertension, gout, end-stage renal disease who underwent kidney transplant from a deceased donor. The CMV status was donor positive, recipient negative. Induction immunosuppression was antithymocyte globulin, so a little more immunosuppressive. Maintenance immunosuppression included tacrolimus and mycophenolate, so was steroid-free. Prophylaxis, as per the IMPACT trial, was valganciclovir planned for 6 months and trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole for 12 months. 16 months after transplant, so about 10 months after the end of prophylaxis, he presented with fatigue and some chills. He was afebrile. His exam was unremarkable. His blood work showed a white blood cell count of 1.6 with 16% atypical lymphocytes. So atypical lymphocytes, highly suspicious for an active viral infection, either CMV or EBV or others. His white blood cell count had previously been 3.7, so now it's half at 1.6. His platelets were 90,000. Previously, he'd been in the 350,000 range. And his CMV plasma PCR was 25,340 IU per mil. So pretty, this is CMV. This definitely needs to be treated. He was started on valganciclovir treatment dose, 900 milligrams twice a day. His symptoms improved. By week two, the CMV PCR result was 7,000. By week four, CMV PCR was 5,000. But that's 4 weeks into therapy. So, he was 25,000, 7,000, and then 5,000. After 4 weeks, that's a pretty slow drop. So you're beginning to wonder. And then by week six, his CMV PCR had gone up to 18,000 from 5,000. Okay, so right there we have resistant refractory CMV. If we just review the definitions of treatment refractory CMV, it's plasma viral load not decreasing by at least one log after at least 2 or more weeks of appropriately dosed antiviral therapy, along with worsening signs and symptoms or progression into end organ disease after at least 2 weeks of appropriately dosed antiviral therapy. Drug-resistant CMV is when we actually detect a viral genetic alteration through specific testing that decreases susceptibility to one or more antiviral drugs. So, what is the impact of drug-resistant CMV? Well, it's quite significant. First of all, the frequency in the solid organ population is really quite variable, and I know that some institutions have higher rates than others. In general, from the IMPACT trial, we think that it's about 0 to 3% after 100 to 200 days of valganciclovir prophylaxis in higher risk kidney transplant recipients. It is higher in those that receive ganciclovir therapy, sort of in the 5 to 12% range among all solid organ recipients, and then up to 18% in lung transplant recipients or 31% in intestinal and multivisceral recipients. It does range from asymptomatic infection, or what we call asymptomatic CMV DNAemia, to severe or fatal tissue invasive disease. And we've recently had a case of that I saw. It is associated with poor outcomes. They have higher rates of adverse events from alternative therapies, as we've outlined with the various antiviral agents, higher rates of rejection and allograft loss, and increased mortality. There's a higher rate of hospitalization, increased length of stay, and definitely higher costs. So this is a pretty big deal. What are risk factors? Well, first and foremost, it is reduced CMV-specific host immunity. So that's when we see the CMV donor positive recipient negative situation. Also, when there's potent immunosuppression, perhaps recent treatment of rejection, and then lung transplant recipients seem to be especially vulnerable. We tend to think of this when there's prolonged exposure to antiviral therapy or prophylaxis, usually after at least 6 weeks of ganciclovir exposure. And also, if there's prolonged DNAemia, what some call viral load, but is more accurately DNAemia, for at least 21 days while on antiviral therapy, and that's basically just significant virus exposure to antiviral therapy that increases the risk of resistance. And also subtherapeutic drug concentrations. So sometimes we see that with decreased oral absorption, or when the dose is of prophylaxis, usually, or sometimes treatment is inappropriately reduced to avoid bone marrow suppression. So some people, I know that some groups say, oh, we're seeing low white blood cell count, we'll just cut the dose of valganciclovir in half. But that's actually, I usually say, one of the cardinal sins, because that will result in a much higher rate of resistant refractory disease. So really important to dose the valganciclovir correctly. So when do you test for drug resistant CMV? Well, if there's antiviral drug resistance, we should suspect that and test for it when we see refractory infection for at least 2 continuous weeks of appropriately dosed antiviral therapy. And usually we send genotypic testing for viral drug resistance mutations, often in the UL97 and UL54 genes. And then if they've been exposed to letermovir, the UL56 gene as well. So here's the resistance testing for our case. So he did have one of the common mutations. I mentioned before, we see the majority of mutations in the UL97 gene. About 90% of the initial mutations are found there. He had this H520Q, which is relatively common and conveys high-level resistance. So the kidney transplant team is asking for guidance. His clearance is about 38 mils per minute. White blood cell count is 1.7, and he is expressing priority in saving his kidney allograft. So, how do you put all of that together, and what would the next best choice be? So, if we think about treatment, there are no controlled trial data to define a best practice. Algorithms are based on expert opinion. The first step is always, with any significant transplant infectious disease, reduce immunosuppression to the lowest feasible amount, and then think about available therapies. Could you give high dose ganciclovir? Could you give maribavir, foscarnet, or cidofovir? So we talked a little about maribavir. So this is a nice new option. We reviewed the clinical trial that was really compared maribavir to investigator-assigned therapy with overall much better outcomes for maribavir compared to investigator-assigned therapy and allows for outpatient administration of drug. So there's a suggested algorithm published in a recent article by Raymond Rezanable, who is one of the experts on CMV management. And what he recommended in this algorithm is, as you can see on the left, if there's refractory CMV with a low viral load, they could be started on maribavir. If they have a higher viral load, perhaps starting on foscarnet for induction, followed by maribavir consolidation therapy. People should be aware that if there is CNS involvement or CMV retinitis, we shouldn't use maribavir because it may not reach those protected sites. So then we'd want to use foscarnet. So following that algorithm, we decided to start him on maribavir 400 milligrams twice a day. His CMV PCR steadily declined and he had a nice response. His white blood cell count and clearance, renal clearance remained unchanged. And by week 7 of maribavir, his PCR had fallen to undetectable. He was then switched to letermovir prophylaxis, which was stopped after 3 months of prophylaxis without further CMV infection. I have to say, I do get a lot of questions about what type of prevention do I do at the end of either maribavir or foscarnet therapy for resistant refractory disease. In that, could people use valganciclovir? And the answer is no, because almost undoubtedly that resistant CMV will rear its ugly head again if you because the resistance is still present. So it is quite nice that we can use this new agent, maribavir, and then give prophylaxis with letermovir in this situation. So overall, good outcome. He had good clinical outcome, and the team was all quite pleased with that. So I'm now going to pass it back to you, Zenya, and please discuss a case in stem cell transplant.
Yes, thank you, Camille, for sharing this case with us. And we are happy for the good outcome and avoidance of toxicities and preservation of the kidney allograft. So I'm going to share a case of stem cell transplant. This is the clinical scenario. 62-year-old man with acute myelogenous leukemia. He received an unrelated donor transplant from a mismatched donor. The patient was CMV seropositive and the donor was CMV seronegative. He received post-transplant cyclophosphamide for GVHD prophylaxis. And here already we have certain characteristics that we look for to stratify patients with regards to CMV risk. This patient is considered a high risk because he has multiple high-risk features. He is a CMV seropositive recipient with a negative donor, which means that he's not going to have any passive transfer of CMV-specific T cells from the donor in the allograft. The donor is mismatched, And he also receives post-transplant cyclophosphamide, which has been associated with a higher risk for CMV reactivation compared to calcineurin-based prophylaxis. So we have, again, two options. The first one is letermovir prophylaxis, or the preemptive approach, which would be PCR-guided preemptive use of ganciclovir or valganciclovir should CMV reactivation occur. And there are some points to consider here. Both strategies are effective in preventing CMV disease. However, letermovir prophylaxis, of course, reduces clinically significant CMV infection, as we saw from the results of the phase 3 trial. And importantly, the phase 3 trial and subsequent real-world evidence point to some survival advantage with letermovir prophylaxis. So the current ASTCT guidelines endorse the use of letermovir prophylaxis, particularly in high-risk patients, but in all risk patients, if it is feasible. And so the strategy chosen for this patient was letermovir prophylaxis. Now, at my center, letermovir is available for our patients, so we use it for all patients regardless of risk. We do have minor difference. We start earlier after transplant for the high-risk patients, so we start on day 7 for the high-risk patients compared to at discharge, which would be around week 3 or 4 after transplant for the low risk. Nonetheless, everybody gets letermovir. Now, there are certain settings that perhaps need to ration a little bit letermovir. So clearly, the highest risk patients would be the ones to prioritize, including, as we said, anybody with that receives an HLA mismatched graft, cord blood, anybody who receives T-cell depletion, those would be the highest risk patients. And here you see a study from France that actually used this approach, that all high-risk patients received letermovir. But for the low-risk patients, they only received letermovir prophylaxis if they were given a high-dose prednisone. And you see that with this approach, of course, in the high-risk patients, they were able to show substantial decline in clinically significant CMV infection, but also for the low-risk, the rate of reactivation was very low because they prioritized the low-risk patients on steroids to get prophylaxis. So this is one approach to consider if letermovir is not readily available for all patients. Now, let's move back to our patients. The engraftment happened on day 18. Letermovir began on day 21. And weekly CMV PCR had started on day 18. Now, 2-3 weeks after starting letermovir, you get a result of CMV PCR 600 copies per ml. And here you have a pause because you do not know if this is a breakthrough infection or if it is what we call blip. So in these circumstances, while 630, I would say, is on the low side, what I would do at least was to repeat it and see if it is stable, rising, or declining. Here, in this case, again, letermovir was continued and repeat PCR was negative. This is just to make the point that low-rate viremia that is intermittent may happen during letermovir prophylaxis and may reflect abortive infection because there is no complete shutting down of DNA synthesis, as we showed in the mechanism of action. Now, in terms of monitoring these patients, we heard, I think, in the solid organ world that one of the advantages of giving prophylaxis is to not monitor. However, in the stem cell world, the ASTCT guidelines recommend to continue monitoring during letermovir prophylaxis. Now, going back to the patient, he developed acute GVHD grade 2 on day 66. He started on prednisone 2 milligrams per kilogram in the beginning, but tapered with a quick taper after 1 week. Letermovir was stopped on day 100 and weekly CMV-PCR continued. And on day 140, he developed a CMV-PCR of 6,000 copies. And here, even though we have one value, and I would ask to them to repeat it, it seems that this could be a case of rebound infection, as we discussed, which is most commonly seen in patients with graft versus host disease that have received steroids. What was done in this case? Valganciclovir was initiated, and once viremia resolved, it was stopped. Again, rebound infections occur in patients with GVHD, and that's how the extended duration prophylaxis study support the use of letermovir through 6 months for this type of patients. However, the optimal duration of prophylaxis in these patients has not been really defined. I would just make the point here that when you stop letermovir prophylaxis at day 100, particularly if there is a risk for CMV, continue monitoring. Most of the rebound infections occur within 4 to 6 weeks after stopping letermovir, but certainly the patient should be monitored through the 6 months or later if he still remains immunosuppressed. And I think that concludes my case. Camille, would you have any additional comments or suggestion for this case?
Sounds like expert management. It's so nice that we have so many different ways that we can prevent and treat and take care of CMV these days. I mean, I think we've seen dramatic improvements in the field, which is great. I pretty rarely see bad outcomes from CMV these days. I think our diagnostics have really improved, disease recognition, much better times than before.
I agree with you, and I see that the younger generation of transplant ID physicians are not really that scared of CMV as we grew up to be scared. Well, we are just about out of time. I'd like to thank Dr. Camille Cotton for her invaluable insights and clinical perspectives, and thank you to our audience for participating. By way of summary, I'd like to offer three SMART goals, which stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Be vigilant for CMV infection and disease in solid organ and stem cell transplants. Implement strategies to prevent or treat infection, with appropriate use of standard and novel antivirals, and apply relevant CMV guidelines and best practices to optimize the quality of care and outcome for patients receiving stem cell or solid organ transplants. To receive credit for this activity, please complete the post-test evaluation, and thank you again for participating.